The Big Wake Up by Mark Coggins is what you hope every private eye novel will be, says Edgar Award-winning author Megan Abbott. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 2. A Universe of Stars, a Galaxy of Dents. The gripman turned out to be a guy named Dara Finnegan, which is about as Irish a name as you can get without starting the last part with O apostrophe. He had been caught up in a sting involving undercover security guards who were put on cable cars to find crews pocketing fares from tourists. Finnegan and the conductor from his crew had been suspended for allegedly skimming over $25,000. His girlfriend had dumped him, and, thanks to his high profile from press coverage, he was also under investigation by the INS for being in the country illegally. And he was pissed. On the day of the shooting, he donned his Muni uniform and met his old cable car at the second stop up from the turnaround at Beach Street. He shot and killed the replacement crew and three passengers who had waited in the rain to ride a cable car on a miserable February afternoon. Two of the three were tourists from Germany, and the other was the undercover security guard who caught him skimming fares. Finnegan then rode the car to the stop across from Lombard, the crookedest street in the world, and critically wounded another tourist from Lawrence, Kansas. The next stop was the one in front of Swenson's, where the two women waited. The panty girl's name was Araceli Riviero. She was 23, a native of Argentina, and was in the U.S. on a visa to study pharmacology at UCSF. The older woman was the organist at the New Korean Methodist Church and was known to her friends as Snowflake. The only thing that wasn't known was where exactly Finnegan managed to get hold of the machine guns. There were dark rumors about connections to the Irish Republican Army, but since Finnegan wasn't talking, the rumors came to naught. That left yours truly. The cops weren't exactly ready to pin any medals on me. I'd caused an estimated $100,000 worth of personal and municipal property damage, for starters, but there was no denying that things would have been a whole lot worse if I hadn't shown up. The cable car was due to pass through the popular Union Square shopping district, and rain or no rain, there were definitely more people in the line of fire. Finnegan was waiting for them, too. A duffel bag full of loaded magazines was found dangling from one of the control levers of the wrecked car. I got kicked loose from the Bryant Street station well after midnight. One of my few friends in the department, a lesbian beat cop, helped me sneak out the employee exit to avoid the feverish piranha school of reporters who were waiting to interview the only guy who could add a little color, if more color was needed, to tomorrow's lead story, SF Muni Gripman Goes Postal, Hijacks Cable Car for Death Tour. I shared the cab with a released prostitute who wanted to be dropped off on Polk near California. After the driver and I both politely declined to join her in a nearby alley for reduced cost favors, we continued to my apartment at the corner of Post and Hyde, where I promptly hid under the covers of my unmade bed and remained there for 3 days, not answering the phone or the door buzzer or paying attention to the TV, the radio, or the transmissions from Alpha Centauri that I sometimes received from the fillings on my back molars. The thing that finally roused me was a pounding that sounded like someone was using my apartment door for serve and volley practice. Theoretically, it could only be a neighbor or the apartment manager, since the lobby door was on a buzzer system. But the occasional wastrel had been known to make it through. I padded up to the door in my bathrobe and looked through the peephole. I nodded to myself. It was one of the biggest wastrels I knew, Chris Duckworth. Duckworth and I had met on a case several years ago, and although it surprised me to admit it, he had probably become my best friend. It surprised me because I doubted that in a hypothetical survey of our eHarmony 29 dimensions of compatibility, we would come up with a single match. Not that Chris would be allowed to use the service in the first place, since, to quote one of his many pithy expressions he used to convey his sexual preference, he was gay as a fondue fork. I slipped off the security chain, undid the locks, and pulled open the door. He stood in the hallway with two packages carefully wrapped with butcher paper and string. He was a slight man, barely 5'5", and the packages came up nearly to his chin. But to the casual observer, details about height and what he was carrying would hardly have rated a mention. What could not have gone unmarked was the fact that he was dressed as a French maid, a very sexy and convincing female French maid. "I didn't ring for service," I said with mock severity.
"There's no service in this dump, much less a place to ring for it. I'm doing the early show at Aunt Charlie's."
Aunt Charlie's Lounge had a drag queen review where Chris sang torch songs under the name of Cassandra. I often played bass in the band that accompanied him. "Why are you here, then?"
"I'm just checking to see if you've grown out your fingernails or started collecting your urine in jars."
"Fingernails take time, but I've been doing the urine thing for years. It's best to go with pickle jars because of the wide..."
"Spare me."
"You started it. What's in the packages?" Chris sauntered into the room and dumped the packages on the folding card table I use for dining. If consuming TV dinners and burritos could properly be referred to as dining. He pulled off a cashmere topcoat, folded it carefully, and set it down on the arm of my ratty sofa. After brushing a few Oreo cookie crumbs from a cushion, he perched on the edge of it and surveyed the room.
"I like how you've remained true to your original artistic vision. The bowling pin lamp, for instance, is a nice touch."
"Yeah, well, the lava one fell off the cinder block." I shoved the door closed and walked over to the card table. "So what's in the packages?"
"See for yourself."
I yanked the cord off the top one and tore open the paper. A pair of Converse Chuck Taylors with new white laces were inside. My Chuck Taylors. The bottom one had my sheets and towels from the laundromat, neatly folded and pressed. "Wow, you didn't have to do that, Chris, but thank you. How'd you even know where to find them?" He reached up to resettle the headpiece of his costume atop his blonde wig.
"Well, while you've been playing the Howard Hughes recluse, the rest of the world has been busy broadcasting stories about the cable car hero, meaning you. Most of them mentioned that you were doing your laundry when the whole thing started. I found everything in a big pile on the folding table."
He looked down at his hands.
"Did you really see those two women get killed?"
I slumped into one of the rickety chairs that went with the table and pushed the laundry to one side. I couldn't actually see it. The cable car was in the way. But it was certainly one of the worst experiences of my life. One second they were there, and the next they were lying on the ground. The arbitrariness of it was what got me. It reminded me of the Flitcraft story, only with a bad ending.
"The Flitcraft story?"
"It's a sort of parable from the Maltese Falcon. The point is that there's no master plan in the world, no karma. Your actions on this earth have no bearing on what happens to you."
"Jeez, August, I didn't realize we were going to be diving into metaphysics here. Is that why you've been holed up for the past 3 days?
I picked at the wrapping paper from one of the packages, then forced a grin onto my face. "That, and I was waiting for the maid to bring me my damn laundry." Chris smiled back at me, more, I suspected, from relief at having the subject changed than amusement.
"Well, it wasn't just your laundry you abandoned, you know. And this maid can't help you with it. You need a wrecker."
"What are you talking about?"
"Your car, or what's left of it. They've got it at the impound lot. Gretchen told me they're towing it to the junkyard unless you claim it by this afternoon. I didn't think you'd care, but..."
I jumped up from the table. Gretchen was my admin, so they must have called my office when they didn't get hold of me here. "Did you drive?"
"Yeah, I checked out one of those car share Priuses. Why?"
"You're taking me to the impound lot. Hold on while I get changed." Chris started to say something about missing his rehearsal, but I closed the bedroom door on him before he could finish. We got to the impound lot just as the Pick Your Part tow truck was hooking up the Galaxy. I told the driver he wouldn't be picking any of my parts and sent him and the Galaxy to Caesar's garage on Turk instead. Caesar did a brisk business in fixing German makes that were out of warranty or whose owners refused to pay full boat for dealer repair. He'd arrived in San Francisco from Ecuador in 1971, penniless with almost no friends, but thanks to a burning sense of entrepreneurship, had worked his way up from a tiny two-car repair shop to a multi-story garage that now occupied the whole block in the admittedly seedy Tenderloin neighborhood. Since my own apartment was right on the fringes of that same neighborhood, I rented a parking spot from him and used him for the limited amount of maintenance I saw fit to underwrite on the Galaxy. It was late in the day, and no one was at the customer entrance of the garage when we arrived. Chris barely managed a full stop, hustling me out of the Prius and humming the opening bars of Falling in Love Again under his breath before he yanked the door closed and sped off to Charlie's. The tow truck driver just chuckled as he lowered the Galaxy onto the concrete ramp. Both doors and both quarter panels on the left side were smashed. The hood was crumpled, and the bumper was tied on with a rope. The capper came when the front end hit the ground, and the left front wheel canted out 30 degrees. "Good luck, Chief," said the driver, and drove off whistling an out-of-tune rendition of Turkey in the Straw. I heard steps echoing down the ramp from upstairs, and gradually Caesar came into view. He was dressed in the garage uniform of navy blue pants and shirt, both of which were spotless and crisply pressed in spite of the hour. His shoes were shined to a high gloss, and his jet black hair was combed back, accentuating the gray wings at his temples. Give him a corncob pipe and a few inches, and he could have been the General MacArthur of garage mechanics.
"Your parking space is downstairs, senor."
"Yeah, I know. The thing is, I'm having a little trouble making it there." He grinned at me.
"Did you run out of gas?"
"I might have, but there seemed to be contributing factors." He made a slow circuit around the car, touching dents here and there and finally stopping in front of the hood. He laid a pair of latex-gloved hands on one of the few uncrumpled spots and pressed down. The car only yielded an inch or so, making a terrible grating noise as it moved.
"That will be your tie rods, or your axle, or both."
"Can you fix it?"
"I've seen the news stories about the cable car, senor. What you did was very brave."
I felt the heat rise in my cheeks. Caesar and I rarely exchanged words, and most of those were taken up by the good-natured jokes he and the other mechanics made about my car. I wasn't exactly comfortable incorporating hero worship into the relationship at this point. I made a show of straightening the radio antenna. It didn't straighten worth beans. "You would have done the same," I said finally.
"I don't know. I think that is one of those things you can only know when it happens."
He peeled off his gloves and put them in his back pocket.
"The car is totaled, senor. There is no point in repairing it. Get a new one. I have a nice Mercedes I can give you a good price on."
Totaled just means it costs more to fix than the car is worth for resale. By that measure, it was probably totaled before the crash. But as much as I'd like a Mercedes, this car has sentimental value to me. I want to repair it.
"Even if I fix the front end and all the body damage, it still has a 40-year-old drivetrain. I've seen the exhaust rolling out of this thing. Every time you came out of the garage, you nearly gassed us to death. I'd be surprised if half the cylinders have compression."
"Then rebuild the engine and the transmission if you have to." He shook his head.
"That is silly. If you really want to drive around in a 1968 Galaxy 500, you should buy one that has already been restored. It will be much cheaper."
"Are you saying you won't do it, even if I pay you the money?"
"No, I'm saying that it doesn't make sense. Perhaps you are a little rattled from the accident. Anyone would be."
My hand closed around the St. Apollonia medal I carried in my pocket and I squeezed. I strained to keep my voice level. "Look, this is my father's car. It's the only thing I have from him. I don't want to lose it."
"Oh, that is different. Why didn't you say so?"
"I just did." He nodded like someone trying to be reasonable when the other party wasn't.
"I'll run an estimate and call you tomorrow, but I have to close now."
He came up to where I was standing and reached over to touch my shoulder.
"You know the girl, Araceli Rivero?"
My mouth went dry. "Yes?"
"She was a member of our church, Mission Dolores. There are many people from Central and South America in the congregation. They are holding a vigil for her this evening. I think you should come.
You have been listening to The Big Wake Up, a book Publishers Weekly described as outstanding in a starred review. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.